imaging camera if you want to really be exact, but you can get a good enough answer with great efficiency, with great accuracy, great sensitivity. Does it get hot when you put power into it? You see where I'm going in that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet. Been there, done that.
Yeah, see, Dick, I think we're on the same wavelength here on this one. There was, I kind of looked at it in one direction, you're looking at it from the thermal direction, but I think we're both seeing a very, very similar effect here, that the amount of power lost, or if you were to look at the efficiency of a half-wave length antenna, from the amount of power that you put into what's actually being radiated out, is very, very high efficiency. What kind of increase in efficiency would you expect to see if it was a superconductor? K2IW, KC2QIQ.
By the way that you and I would build a half-wave dipole on almost any frequency, Glenn, you're going to start off with 99% efficiency. And yeah, if you make a superconductor, you can make it 99.999. I can also decide that the inefficiency of a dipole is primarily a function of the resistance of the materials, and then the secondary inefficiency might be the lost tangent of the dielectric materials that are supporting the antenna. Let's talk about the first one, the resistor materials. If the resistance of the wire that goes into a dipole antenna on an HF frequency is the primary mechanism of loss, and if I use a large enough diameter of wire, or a birdcage of multiple wires, where I electronically make it look like a large diameter conductor with high conductivity without creating a whole lot of weight and wind load, once I recognize the inefficiency mechanism, you and I have the resources to make that efficiency go 10 times higher without getting heroic by recognizing what I do by making enough parallel conductors, by making the wire larger than the diameter, or use enough parallel wires. So I would much rather do that and try to make an 80-meter dipole 132 feet long, completely superconducting, and insulate that whole 32-foot length and put liquid nitrogen in that whole 32-foot length. You can see the resources required to make it superconducting in the real world are, by my standards, expensive and heroic. KC2QIQ, fun to talk about, though. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, as I said, I really believe we're on the same page on this one. And I just was afraid that your answer was really getting kind of lost in the discussion. And that really, that, like you're saying, the idea of talking about heroic, that in order to make something superconductor, the amount of efficiency improvement is so small in comparison to the expense and complexity and possibly the detuning of everything that you'd have to do to make it superconducting. It's just really not practical. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to repeat what you just said, Glenn, and add a couple of words to it. Any reasonable design HF antenna and VHF antenna you and I use, if it's a reasonable design with a good track record, it starts off at 98% efficiency. And therefore, this is not the thing to lose sleep over. Whether or not the VHF antenna is high enough to clear the trees and clear the local buildings and the hill nearby and whatever, much bigger importance than efficiency. And let me show you something else that's going on here. You got to recognize where the real numbers are. Who's eating your lunch, as I say it. If I increase the efficiency of a 90% antenna to 99%, I'm making half a decibel of improvement. At first, that sounds like a whole lot, 90% to 99%. As far as loss is concerned, I've changed it by a 10 to 1 ratio. As far as efficiency is concerned, I've made it a 10% improvement. As far as decibels are concerned, I've made half a decibel of improvement. By comparison, in some circumstances, I raised the antenna 10 more feet in altitude, and the signal I listened to just got 10 decibels stronger. You got to recognize where's the tall pole in the tent, if you know what I mean. And as I said, who's eating your lunch? The inefficiency of the antenna is a minor factor. And let me show you one other place on this one. Let me drop it. A consulting client I had 1 month ago was losing a whole lot of sleep over the antenna he was buying for a particular application. This is a very small, compact antenna that had to go into a tiny little space. And antenna brand A was 2 decibels of gain over isotropic. Antenna brand B was one decibel of gain over isotropic, and he was fretting over the fact that the 2 dB gain antenna was a much better antenna. He thought 2 to 1 better. It's really because of the way the decibels were, only a 30% improvement, but he thought it was 2 to 1 dB, 2 to 1 better, but it was twice the price, and he was fretting over that. And I told him, if you bought a 0 dB gain over isotropic antenna, and you try to calculate decibels per dB, dollars per dB, and you're dividing by 0, you're going to think that antenna is really terrible. In reality, you just move the placement of the antenna a little bit, and you can make 5 dB of improvement in the signal that you transmit. And whether or not the antenna has got 1 dB gain or 2 dB of gain is a wash. It's spitting in the ocean, if you know what I mean. And the way decibels work, 0 dB of gain over isotropic in some environments is an extremely good antenna. The crazy way dBs work, because it's a ratio and not an absolute. 0 watts of gain out of antenna is really nothing. 0 dB of gain out of an antenna, because it's comparison to another antenna called isotropic, 0 dB of gain is a damn good antenna. So don't worry about the minor details of dBs. In the case of VHF, mount the antenna in the right place. Altitude, altitude, altitude. Location, location, location is what makes the antenna work well. And dollars you spend may not be it. Put your investment into altitude. Use a higher tree, a higher tower, whatever. Wonder how you feel on that one, Glenn. KC2 QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, very well stated, Dick. That's right on the mark. Sometimes, you know, these questions come in, and you can definitely tell that they're not really seeing the whole picture. You know, they're thinking, oh, okay, by going to superconductivity, I'm going to see, you know, a lossless antenna, which is probably the way of the future. In reality, it's really not the picture. But very well stated, Dick. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
So those guys are doing some good thinking there, Glenn. And what's the next mailbag question? KC2QIQ. Keep it up. K2RIW, the thing there.
KC2WGB. Okay. Dick, you and I had a conversation just the other night, and it involved your tuning of a Yagi and using a voltage to frequency converter. And this gentleman would like more on that. He did not hear the whole conversation, and he thinks it's a great idea. He has some Yagis he wants to tune, and he thought it would just be great if you could run that by him. Don't have to go through the whole setup of what you were doing, but basically how to tune it with a voltage to frequency converter and what you were actually doing. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
There's quite a bit more to this story than first meets the eye. Airborne Instruments Laboratory, I'm going to guess 1975, 1973, purchased the Jacek Antenna Engineering Laboratory in Syosset, New York, along with Henry Jacek, who became a vice president and the head of the antenna engineering department, and he and I developed a pretty good relationship. He's the guy who is the editor of the Jacek Antenna Engineering Handbook, one of the Bibles on the subject. As you can tell, I was very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time at that company to meet some very intelligent people, like Hank Keene, WQCTK, who taught me everything there was to know in theory about strip line. And so the strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier came out of that. He's one of the developers of strip line, and there's about 5 more of those guys. So I'm in the right place. As long as I stayed friendly with them and walked into their office at the right time, they would ask any question, answer any question in the world, other than how to get rich quick and how to get all the bonds to be the path to my door. That's another whole subject. Let me drop. So Henry and I had a running debate that ran on for a couple of years because he had accepted a military contract to build the highest possible gain in a Yagi antenna. And in 1978, I came out with a 19-element insulated Yagi, which had more gain than that. And he thought that I was exceeding the laws of physics. Turns out I was using a different law, a different set of concepts as to how to build the antenna. I had set up an antenna range, a ratiometry antenna range. You can read about that in the February issue, QST Magazine. I think it's 1985, 87. I'll have to find out. You go to the archives of QST and you look up K2RIW and ratiometry antenna, you'll find the article. The bottom line of that is that I had set up an antenna range in my backyard, a 90-foot-long antenna range right across the lawn parallel to the back of the house, in between the house and the woods that was 40 feet away, so to speak, in this little narrow channel of material, I had set up an antenna range that was very different than any antenna range people had heard about up till then. Let me drop. I had recognized the fact that when everybody builds an antenna range to peak up an antenna and at VHF frequencies, unless you're a billionaire, it's got to be an outdoor antenna range because you can't afford that anechoic chamber, if you know what I mean. So with an outdoor antenna range, a couple of things are going to fight you. Con Ed and LIPA are going up and down in voltage they deliver, therefore your transmitter is going up and down in power output. You start off at 8 o'clock in the morning when there's dew on the grass and the dirt is nice and wet, and by the time you make measurements at noontime, the dirt dries out. The reflection off the ground is changing in magnitude and phase. So direct gain measurement with a transmitter that's changing in power and ground that's changing in reflection, the apparent gain of the antenna goes up and down in funny ways. That'll drive you crazy. Let me drop. I recognized all this and I said, it's time we measure the ratio instead of measure the gain. I put two antennas side by side. They happen to be two Yagis. One of them I'm tuning and one of them is a stand. I got two Yagis side by side, roughly 10 feet apart. They're both looking at the same transmitter. The two cables out of those two antennas go into a Hewlett Packard 416, I think it is, ratiometer. And that thing will easily measure a 0.01 dB of gain difference between those two signals it's seeing. This is a thing I bought on the surplus market. In fact, I bought it as a thing that was being thrown away by AIL. Anyhow, that ratiometer would allow me to, it's got common mode rejection just like an operational amplifier. If one antenna got better than the other by a tenth of a dB or 0.05 dB, I could resolve it. The transmitter going up and down in power affected both antennas the same, and that became a wash. The ground reflection changing, that became a wash. I could therefore repeatably resolve 0.05 dB, a 20th of a dB of gain change, morning, noon, and night, even 2 o'clock in the morning, I could resolve that amount of gain change. Now when you're slowly tweaking an antenna, and you can resolve a 20th of a dB of gain change, it's like a sight-impaired person walking up a hill. You can feel the difference. You can now know when you're going in the right direction and say, keep doing that. The gain is going up. Whatever I'm doing, keep doing it. And the next thing I realize is that this ratiometer sitting on a picnic table down at the ground level, so to speak, and I'm up on top of a wooden ladder tuning this Yagi antenna, I recognize that the Dassendal movement is a long distance away from me, and I can't see it. Therefore, what I did next was to create a voltage-to-frequency converter. Let me drop. As the needle went up and down on the ratiometer, telling me whether the gain is going up and down, I converted that to a tone. Now I'm listening to the tone, and when the gain goes up, the tone gets higher. When the gain goes down, the tone gets lower. I'm listening to the tone coming out of the loudspeaker, out of a voltage-to-frequency converter that I created, a fairly simple circuit. Now I can be tuning the antenna without looking at it. I'm only looking at the elements I'm tuning with, and there's a bunch of hidden results that came out of that. Every so often you would wave your hand by mistake alongside of a director, and as your hand waved by the director, you're adding capacitance to the tip of the director. That tunes it to a slightly lower frequency as your hand waves by, and if the tone goes up at that instant, you say, whoa, I just increased the gain of that antenna. I'm listening to the tone. It went up a little bit and then back down as my hand waved by the element. And I could tell by the timing which element my hand waved by when the tone went up. And I said, hey, that element wants to be longer. And so serendipity struck, and I found all kinds of ways of making higher gain antennas with this tone to frequency converter on this ratiometry antenna range. Let me drop. And the next thing I did is I created a whole bunch of antenna tuning tools on little bitty long skewers of wood, sticks that you use for making shish kebabs, so to speak. I put a piece of copper tape on the end of it, and as I wave that tool near the tip of an antenna, electronically I'm tuning it to a lower frequency because I'm adding capacitance, and I'm listening to whether the tone goes up and down. So I could wave the tune near each one of the elements and find out which one wants to be longer. Then by using a slightly larger piece of copper tape or aluminum tape on the end of one of these skewers, standing out of the field of the antenna, because it's a long enough stick of wood, if I put it near the center of a dipole-like element, the director, if I put it near the center of the element, parallel to the rod, I'm shunting the magnetic field in the center that tunes the director to a higher frequency. So putting the tuning tool near the center of the element makes it go higher in frequency. Putting the tuning tool near the tip as capacitance makes it go to a lower frequency. I can therefore go down the string of Yagi elements, find out exactly which element wants to be higher or lower, and perform that magic, so to speak, and the antennas slowly get better and better again. After a week of tuning these antennas like this, let me drop. After a week of tuning a Yagi antenna like that, I went over to the East Coast VHF Society antenna gain competition, run by Paul Wade, W82ZZF in those days, the W1 gigahertz, G8Z these days, at Saddlebrook Park in New Jersey, and that went on for about 10 years. I go there with this Yagi antenna and win the antenna gain competition. There were guys there from about 5 states, probably 10 or 15 antennas. That was a 19-element Yagi. That was 1978, 77 or 78, and for about a 4-year period of time, arguably that was the highest gain Yagi in the world, with performance measured on traceability hardware, traceable to the Bureau, if you know what I mean. And it was in the vicinity of 15.5 dB of gain over dipole, around 17 dB of gain over isotropic, was that 19-element Yagi on 432. 12.5-foot long boom, 1 pound or so of antenna, and 19 of them became the thing you'll see on that red QSL card. If you Google my call letters, K2RIW, and you look at that QSL card, you'll see me standing in the middle of 16 of those elements, 16 of those Yagis. It's a 3,500 cubic foot antenna with me standing in the middle of it on the top of a 100 feet of tower, and that thing, 304 elements altogether. It had 29 dB of gain altogether, and that did some very interesting things, that antenna. So with the right cutesy techniques on what you and I would think was a really terrible antenna range, but I corrected many of the reflections of the antenna range, didn't affect me because I'm only looking for differential improvement of one antenna over the other. I was wiping out any changes of the transmitter power, any ground reflection. The drop.
By the way, it's February 1976, QST, page 22, UHF antenna ratiometry.
UHF antenna ratiometry, an outdoor range improvement technique. I think it's the total. Is that the whole title? Did I get it right? I think I know the author, but I don't remember when he did it. Over to you, Lou.
Yeah, it came back on their search on the QST ARL, February 1976. And I guess it's abbreviated UHF antenna ratiometry. With you as the author, and keywords theory, UHF antenna, it's on page 22. And I don't know if it's available on their site, it may be, but they certainly found it.
If you're an ARRL member, you have full access to their archives and all of the articles that they've published in the recent few decades are available. So as an ARRL member, now that you know what you're looking for, you can get a hard copy of that article itself, even without trying to find that particular magazine in your pile of magazines in the basement, if you know what I mean, or in your library. However, I'll warn you a little bit. The website for archives of articles of QST on the ARRL website is a little bit persnickety. There are times when I know the name of the author, I know his call letters, I know the year the article was published, I know the page it was on, and I try to do a search in their archive for that particular article. And I do that search on Monday, and it tells me it doesn't exist. I go back and sign in on Tuesday, and it finds it immediately for me. So there's something a little bit persnickety. So if at first their archive doesn't find it for you, don't give up. It's there, if you know what I mean, if you remember. So you can get a copy of that article. And that article was a compendium. It was a squeezed-down version of an IEEE presentation I made at New York City during one of the IEEE shows that exact year, 1 year before that. Let me drop. So part of the magic of what made this antenna range of mine work so well was the ratiometry technique, the tuning tools technique, and the voltage to frequency converter connected to the voltage output from a ratio meter, Hewlett-Packard 416. And so now, by converting it to tone, and as I was telling John, I'm sure that for sightless human beings, there must be some test equipment you can buy where you're picking up your transmitter or you're aligning the antenna or whatever. And by the voltage being converted to a tone, a sight-impaired person could listen to that tone going up and down in pitch and know when he's doing the right thing with this piece of ham radio. There's ways with a 555 integrated circuit chip. Signetics, among other companies, used to make a specific little integrated circuit that's called voltage-to-frequency converter. It's not too complicated. It's not rocket science to make a voltage-to-frequency converter, but there are times when that is very handy, and I described one to you. And so that combination of QT ideas allowed me to come up with what I thought at the time was state-of-the-art in Yagi antennas, and that exact antenna appeared as the front cover of the AIL Record Company magazine about that year, and the apparent gain of that antenna was exceeding what Henry Jasek thought was possible, because he was using a different tuning technique, and he didn't find the magic that I found, and he and I eventually settled our differences on that subject. And so a little bit of history there. I probably went further than you needed to, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the Tech Net.
Okay, very quickly, I see, I got the article, it's a picture of your XYL standing precariously on some equipment here.
Exactly, my wife Charlene was in the picture. You got these two step ladders, wooden step ladders, side by side, acting as the support structure, the miniature towers, so to speak, for the two antennas. The standard Yagi antenna was on the left, the one I was tuning was on the right. Left antenna was on the left-hand wooden ladder. Right antenna was on the right-hand wooden ladder. And I think I was standing there with a tuning tool in my hand, I think, in the picture near the right-hand Yagi. And I believe my wife was standing on the left-hand ladder in the photograph, as I remember. Well, maybe she was the only one in the picture. But it gave you a little bit of a picture of how you set up an antenna ratiometry, antenna range. You'll see that it's very simple equipment in the backyard with a picnic table holding the equipment and these two wooden ladders. And the bottom line of that is that arguably the world's best antenna range that's owned by the Air Force at Rome Air Development Center near Utica, New York, is now using a ratiometry antenna range. And I wonder where that came from. KC2WGB. And by the way, 10 years later, I had a chance to do a couple of months' worth of work at the Rome Air Development Center. Air Force Center in, as I said, in Utica, New York. Newport, New York is the actual place. Good group of guys, fun material. And that particular antenna range, what the Air Force has done is to gather an old discarded model of every single modern aircraft that the Air Force ever uses. They've got one of the ones that are out of service on that site. Therefore, if you want to, as I did at one time, put an antenna installed on an F-15E aircraft. You take a full-size F-15 aircraft, mount it on top of their pedestal 35 feet high, upside down, install your antennas on that airplane. That pedestal swings your airplane left and right at azimuth and elevation. You let repeater time out. You light up the airplane with a signal that comes from Tanner Hill, the mountain 1.5 miles away, that transmits the signal to the airplane. You swing your airplane back and forth while making strip shot recordings on a Scientific Atlanta strip shot recorder. Was it Scientific Atlanta? Yeah, I think it was Scientific Atlanta. And so you make real installed measurements on a real antenna on a real airplane. You don't worry about modeling errors and whatever. But because you mount the antenna, the whole aircraft upside down, while making that measurement for a whole bunch of mechanical reasons, that site claims to have the biggest upside-down Air Force in the world. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, wow. Claims of fame, upside-down Air Force. All right, that's about it from the mailbag. I'm sure he's going to love it because now he even has the website where to go to at ARRL to be able to get some more information and maybe read that article. So, yeah, great stuff. But he was very interested in how that was done. He thinks he can save a lot of time doing that.
Okay, it's time we go over to Paul, and thank you. Very good questions. Talk to you later. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Now, let me give you guys a little bit of warning. That article in QST Magazine on the ratiometry antenna range, it came from the original presentation I made at the IEEE meeting in New York City about a year earlier. And if you go to the original IEEE article, you'll get the real thing. Unfortunately, the article was longer than could be an article in QST. It had to be compacted. The person who did the compacting of the article didn't have complete understanding of the material. He somehow came to the conclusion that these great big fancy-looking equations was the exciting part, and he repeated the equations in the QST article. Some of the words that went with it that was in the original IEEE article got dropped. So I wasn't in complete agreement with the method by which the article got compacted. And therefore, the bottom line is when you read that article, it's not quite as clear as you'd like it to be. Thank goodness the diagram came through. Once you see the stick figure diagram of how you set up an antenna range, a guy with a little bit of skill in the art of setting up an antenna range will see right away what's going on. Don't let those great big equations there scare you. It was there because, as I said, they thought that was the exciting part of the article. And I know that a number of hams, when they see an equation, get turned off right away. So be forewarned, don't let that turn you off. Paul, what in the world is NASA doing these days? WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet. You got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick, this is WS2N. Seems like the year 2020, a couple of things are coming out. One will be the new rover, Curiosity, is riding around on Mars now, which landed last August and doing a good job. In fact, it's really getting ready to, in fact, is driving at least 300 feet a day is the goal. And they want to drive to Mount Sharp, which is about 5 miles away. So Curiosity is doing good. They've done a lot of research in roughly the area that they've been in. But now they're going to put on some miles and then try to get to their main destination of Mount Sharp. Plutonium operated saying, well, in 2020, they want to put another one of these similar robots on Mars, except with more refined instruments. Again, it'll probably be plutonium operated, but maybe also solar operated, maybe both of them, or just solar. They haven't really come to the conclusion, but probably plutonium operated. I know we've talked about this rover before, but now some other details are coming out about it. They plan on not only drilling into the rocks and getting powder out of the rocks, which is what they're doing now, and then putting it into the chem lab inside the rover or the SAM lab to do a evaluation. They actually want to do a core sample, very small. I mean, what it would look like. It looks like probably 3/8 of an inch diameter core sample. They can't really tell about that size it looks, and they'll take those and use basically microscopes to stare at this thing in extremely high resolution, and essentially looking for bacterial fossils, the way they put it. So if they can find something like that, they can actually show that there was some kind of bacterial or microbial life at one time on Mars. So that's going to be added to the rover, as well as a couple of other features. I'd like to store some of these core samples and eventually have another mission in the future, go there, meet up with this rover, and take the samples from it and have a sample return. From what I've read, with all the sophisticated equipment that's for the rovers, there's nothing like bringing a little piece back and examining it here. And then as time goes on, 10, 20 years out, who knows, maybe 30 years out, the investigation tools here on Earth become even more and more sophisticated. So you could take a sample return that you might get back 5, 10 years from now, and 20 years from now, look at something with new eyes and say, "Ha ha, look at this." So that's one of the goals with the new Welcome to 2020 drop. One other thing in 2020 that will happen, hopefully, is that the European Space Agency will come up with a new heavy lift rocket. Right now they use the Ariane 5 with all the big lifts, and they plan on even upgrading that for about 20% increase in payload. But in 2020 they plan on having the Ariane 6 built. I mean, they talked about doing this 10 years ago, but now it's been financed, approved, and also they'll start working on it. And what they do is it's more an expensive way to develop the rockets. They'll have three solid booster rockets launch the thing, and then a fourth one for a second stage. So basically four of the same types of rockets. So looks like a lot of companies are going that way. European Space Agency is going to go that way as well. So maybe they'll have a new heavy lift rocket in 2020. And that's pretty much on that. Just one thing, not to do with NASA, but the Large Hadron Collider. An article came out about the new magnets they're building. I don't know if you've read about these magnets, but they're an increase of strength over the old ones. It's got to be pretty significant. And you'll be able to have, out of all these billions of atoms that are hitting each other head on, a lot more of those will be, usable. Magnets stronger, you'll be able to bring the atoms to more of a pinpoint location. I'm saying atoms, but protons.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Very good work out in Geneva, Dick, on that, 17-mile ring. Back to you, Dick. That's pretty much all I had. If you want to discuss anything, we're here. And let me drop this. To bring any topics up, another way of getting into this net indirectly, but through email to me is using net email, which would be spacenetreport@gmail.com. So one of the many ways of getting involved with the TechNet. Back to you, Dick, WS1.
As you guys can see, there's a gathering number of URLs, web addresses. So to talk directly to Paul with space information questions or comments or further information for Paul, that is spacenetreport, all run together, no punctuation, spacenetreport@gmail.com. And the chat room is urwebchat.com/technet. Here we go. urwebchat.com. UR, by the way, is Uniform Romeo. Just those two letters grouped together with no punctuation. urwebchat.com/technet. TECHNET. No punctuation in there. And let's see, there's another one. Oh, yeah, Bernie. When you want to go to the website where we discuss individual internet addresses you can go to so that you and I are, so that you guys and us are seeing the exact same information at the same time. Let me drop.
Yeah, let me just clarify that last one for you.
Yeah, go ahead, Luke.
Alrighty, so Bernie is, he has a Dropbox, which virtually you sign up for, so it's not a website, but it's Bernie's email address, bernie@huntfamily.com. and just request that you be part of that, and he'll set you up, and virtually all you have is a folder on your computer, and every Sunday evening Bernie puts documents in there as they become available, which may be pertinent to the evening's discussions. So that's Bernie@HuntFamily.com. It's an email address, and you just ask Bernie, give him your info, and tell him you want to be part of the Dropbox.
You know, Lou, at the rate we're going, we should have one of those very compact email addresses that when a person goes there, it lists all these other email addresses for them, so they're all in one spot. What do you think? Is that possible? NY2H, K2LIW.
Well, Nancy, who's our web person, has already put this chat room on the front page of the Limark.org website under New News. So that would be a place for it. We have a couple of things. We have a Yahoo group for the club. Limark Inc. Is the name of the INC is the name of the Yahoo group. So yeah, these are all good ideas. I think the club website probably would be a good spot for all of that.
I'll get back to us a little bit slower. Go ahead.
Kilo Delta 2, Delta New York, question.
Okay. Kilo Delta 2, Delta New York. Start off with your name and your question.
My name is Bill. Listen, New Jersey. As a new ham operator, I have a question on IRLP operation.
Okay, on site, we've got one of the experts on that subject, Lou, NY2H. So, Bill, go right ahead with your question.
Okay, I've been experimenting with IRLP. In my area, I am able to reach 441-250 Lyndhurst, which at this time is down. 443-750 Ridgewood, which is active. 44200, which is Patterson. 47000, which is West Orange. And 449775. Let me drop. Out of all of the frequencies that I've mentioned, I'm only able to connect with Woodridge, 443750. I have been trying to the wall repeater on 220 has an IR, no, an Asbury Park repeater, which has a repeater of an IRLP number of 4935. All of the said repeaters have rejected my request, except for the Woodridge repeater. What am I doing wrong? I went to the website. The repeaters in question were non-active at the time.
You've got it, Lou.
Alrighty. First, to clear things up, I am not an expert on RLP. I don't even have my own node, but certainly Eric does and Bernie does, and much of the other guys do. But it sounds to me that if it's not active on the status page, it just means they're down for some reason or other. And if their links are down, you're not going to be able to connect to them. Sounds like you're not doing anything wrong, and that the fact that you can connect to the one, you know, is indication enough that you're squared away with your credentials and everything, and you're working fine. So that's about the only thing I could come up with. I think they're just down. You know, if you look at the node status, that's pretty much real time on the ROP.net website. So I think you're okay.
Okay, well, I thought inactive meant that the node wasn't being used at that time. There are other nodes that were saying they were active and it was connected. I thought the word inactive meant open for business.
Man, you could be right. I don't know the answer to that. Eric, are you available? Maybe you could comment on that.
Kilo Echo 2, KE2EJ. You're around, Eric? KQLIW in the segment. Anybody else on frequency who has some experience with IRLP that might have something to contribute to Bill's question? Give me a call, let us a name right now. K2LIW. Oh, is there somebody trying to sign in?
Maybe we should type that question into the chat room. Maybe somebody's there.
I can tell by the way the machine is behaving when I give it a quick transmission that somebody's attempting to give us information, but he's transmitting without the right PL. He's not coming through the machine, and he happens to be far enough away that I'm not hearing him on the input. So there is a person trying to give us information, but he needs a 136.5 PL tone to come through the machine. We may not be able to give you an immediate answer on this one, Bill. We'll eventually get it to you, or eventually find out at least. And you're allowed to come back and ask again. So, any other comments? Bill, KD2DNY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much. I listen to you all the time. Even when you're not on a TechNet, I find your conversations extremely enlightening. So at this time, KD2DNY, name is Bill, listed in Jersey. We will be standing by, and we will try to do a follow-up on this. I thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Shane, for comment.
Okay, who was that? Give me your call letters and name, sir. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Yes, sir. KF7DNH in Reno, Nevada. So the gentleman's having problems with those repeaters. It may be a simple matter of them not reading your tones right. The further you are from a repeater, the less your tone gets through proper. If the tone isn't exactly right, it will not connect. And as well as when the other, you get to a repeater that has connection already to somebody, is connected to something, it will announce what it's connected to. And then you know the node is working if you get that kind of a reply. You won't be able to get onto that node unless it's the reflector, but you will know that it's working. Now, the common failing that I find of getting to a node and dialing is that the distance. If it does not read your tones correctly, it's a lost cause. Over. KF7BNH.
K7BNH, K2RIW, Reno, Nevada. Thank you. Did that make some sense, Bill? KD2DNY, K2RIW?
I would have to say negative. All the repeaters in question are repeaters that I use all the time. I'm very familiar with them. I have no problems using them. I just can't seem to connect to the IRLP modes.
Right, so for clarification, Bill, are you trying to, are you doing this over the air into a repeater which is hosting its own node, or is this your node which you're trying to connect to another node?
No, negative, it's not my own node. I just went to the IRLP node website. I pulled up some and I tried connecting through IRLP, and only one of them was able to respond to me.
Okay, let me suggest perhaps you may want to contact some of these repeater administrators, because they can set up a preamble code through the touch tone. They may require a certain way of connecting, and they can do that. So they're not all going to be plain vanilla, and it's really the way they set them up. So that's one possibility. I'm not suggesting that it's absolutely got to be that way, but certainly within their purview to set it up in a number of different ways. And maybe it's just something as simple as that. NY2H.
NY2H, KD3DNY. All right, thank you very much for your feedback, and I'll work on it.
When it comes to things to look forward to, first of all, when you go to the website of this repeater group, limarc.org, limarc.org, which stands for Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, you'll find a very elaborate website with 40,000 choices. Your problem is almost too many choices, but it'll take you a while to comb through it all. And Lou was telling us that now the chat room and other things and these web addresses are apparently there. And one of the things we have to look forward to is that in the near future, Dr. Dave Borenstein is going to be heading up a net, maybe on Thursday night, that's not clear, maybe one or two times per month on medical issues. Dr. Borenstein is a person who I can tell favors alternate medical techniques, among other things. And every so often we get a chance to talk to him while he's in his automobile on the way home. And we recognize there's a lot of medical knowledge there we want to tap into. So as soon as he frees up some of the projects that he's involved in, there will be a net there that we can look forward to on this repeater. And as I said, maybe Thursday nights is a guess on my part as to when it might take place. Now, when it comes to what Paul just told us, let me drop. It's darn interesting that those rovers on Mars now, the Mars Science Laboratory, which is called Curiosity, this was it roughly 1 ton of hardware, something the size of a Volkswagen automobile, got dropped onto Mars by that sky crane. Very elaborate landing technique, injection and Mars injection atmosphere landing technique, which worked. And there was only one of them, thank goodness. A couple of $1 billion worth of hardware is now cranking away on Mars and doing some very good things and moving 300 feet per day on that plutonium power supply. I'm guessing the plutonium power supply, which is creating a couple of kilowatts of electrical energy, is the power supply itself. Although it'll slowly decrease in power output, I'll bet you it'll still have a major amount of power output for the next 50 years, is my guess. I'm going to pass it back to Paul in a minute for a confirmation of that. So it's doing some great work. And if you think about it, let me drop it. What they've done is to put this very elaborate laboratory that's got all kinds of tools on board for drilling holes, blasting things with lasers, and making spectral measurements of the components. When you light it up with a laser, there's all kinds of fancy things. A nuclear source that looks at the reflection of the protons coming. It blasts the protons into the soil and looks at the spectrum of what comes back to figure out what's in the soil. There's all kinds of good things. It's sitting in an environment which Mars has almost no atmosphere, so it's continuously being bathed with ultraviolet rays, cosmic rays, solar wind, all kinds of nasty things that you wouldn't want to put a human being there. It's living at temperatures of minus 150 degrees Fahrenheit. Occasionally, that tiny little bit of wind moves 300 or 400 miles an hour. You really don't want to put a human being there. I know that an awful lot of our current youth are looking forward to the day when one of their compatriots is people of their age will be standing on the surface of Mars. I'm a bit skeptical as to whether or not that's going to take place in anything like the near future, because why would you want to send a person to such a hostile environment? And the fact that Saddam, many people signed up to go one way, is kind of amazing to me. But make a guess, Paul, how many years will that power supply, that plutonium power supply on the Mars Science Laboratory, be good for? I made a guess that it's still going to be producing a significant amount of power 50 years from now. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, sure. I mean, all the plutonium RTGs, the radioisotope thermal electric generators that they've been building since the Apollo days. Apollo 12 had one that they put on the moon. After that, you had Pioneer. They ran them for the deep space flight. Voyager, of course, is still operating. And they were launched back in 77. I think they have a half-life. Plutonium-239, I think, is it 87 years? I forgot the half-life, but what's going to go on the, let's say, on Voyager is probably the thermocouples would give out. Or maybe just a piece of hardware failure, you know. I often think of the guys that put that together. You know, somebody probably had to solder something or do something. And if they remember soldering that joint and saying, you know, this is a critical part of Voyager. I wonder how long this is going to last. I wonder if they sit around thinking about that. I know I would be if I was one of the people that worked on that. And I'm sure the same holds true for Curiosity and any other two rovers, one that failed there, Spirit, but Opportunity still going. Now let me drop it. Pathfinder mission, and they had the little rover Sojourner go off. Before they launched that, they were running tests in cryogenic labs, and I remember reading that they were having problems with the wires. You know, it was so cold that they were giving them problems and all the electronic components, so they were trying to keep most of the electronics warm. You know, the plutonium gives not only enough heat to produce electricity, but it has other heat, you know, maybe a couple of thousand watts in Curiosity's case, convert that to heat. That's a lot of BTUs that they could use, and they have in Sojourner and Opportunity, Spirit, not Curiosity, something called a web box. It stands for a warm electronic box. What it basically is, you know, they'll tap the heat off the plutonium, and they'll enter it within the probably the center part of the rover, where a lot of the wires are coming out from the computers, and of course keeping the computers warm, all the electronics, but even the wires that go to different parts, that go to the wheels or whatever it is, as soon as they can get them into this web, this warm electronic box, the better off they are. And they found that works a lot better. It's well designed, and I guess if it doesn't fall off a cliff in the sand, tip over by a crater somewhere, or have trouble, you know, maybe getting stuck going up an incline on Mount Sharp, it's more likely to have a failure doing that than electrical or failure. You might have problems with the wheels, like on Spirit, wheels failed, but for years they used to drag it backwards because the one wheel wasn't working, so they would go in reverse, and it would just slide along. So, probably come back 20, 30 years from now, you'll have power to these rovers. It might be sitting there, you know, spinning its wheels, stuck in sand somewhere there.
Can you imagine the guy who assembled that power supply, the plutonium power supply that really keeps everything running on the Curiosity vehicle on Mars? If that one main A-plus wire coming out of the power supply for some reason should disconnect. I don't have to ask if there's a fuse on there. I know there's no fuse. If for some reason that piece of wire coming out of the power supply should disconnect and everything loses power, I'm not sure there's a backup. I don't think there's more than one plutonium power supply on the vehicle. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, that's the only one. You see the radiators for coming off the back. It looks like a dovetail type of arrangement sticking up. It looks like about maybe 40 degrees sticking up at the back of the Curiosity, right next to the around UHF antenna. That's where the plutonium is. So, yeah, no fuses. I've read that type of thing there. Nobody to go up there to change it. They're well designed. This is what, third generation. And they learned a lot from Sojourner and the last two. One's still riding around on solar panels, you know. But this thing here, ride at night. I mean, you could do a lot more experiments. Had somewhere the difference between the probe and the output. I forgot what it was, but it's probably a 5 to 10 to 1 ratio compared to Spirit and Opportunity.
Yeah, that's the plutonium power supply. I think you and I are of the conclusion there's only one of them. It's the single possible point failure where everything goes dead. I couldn't have said power supply is not going to do that. You'd be amazed how many very sophisticated pieces of electronics sometimes the designer doesn't realize how important the power supply or voltage regulator could be, because all the rest of the electronics would be absolutely perfect, and if the regulator fails or the power supply fails, you're off the air. Nothing's working. And so one of the jobs I had on the B-1B bomber was for designing simple, what you would think are a simple 15 volt, plus or minus 15 volt voltage regulator. High reliability voltage regulator. I seem to remember it was something like 15 volts. It's something like 15 or 30 amperes. I'm not quite sure what the amperes were. And in a case of a constant current voltage regulator, in other words, it's regulated both in current and voltage, if for some reason it sees a short circuit, the voltage regulator will continue to crank out its normal amperes into that short circuit, and all of the power it would have been delivered now becomes dissipated by that regulating transistor. And boy, you can create a whole lot of heat in a hurry. And so one of the things that I designed into them was what's called a fallback power supply. It senses the fact that there's a short circuit there, and it goes to a lower current rating, so it's not dissipating a whole lot of power, but it's continuously putting out current, continuously testing the load of that circuit, and as soon as the short circuit goes away, it pops right back up to normal voltage and normal current, and no fuse required, nothing gets damaged, doesn't burn up things, and so on. So you can make very sophisticated as far as what I call elegance of simplicity. In other words,
repeater, timeout.
The circuit has a lot of survivability. What I mean by the elegance of simplicity. As a schematic diagram, it looks almost like a normal voltage regulator, except it's got one other mysterious resistive feedback path that controls this fallback characteristic. I was reading an article in Electronics Magazine at the time. It's where I got the idea and applied it immediately. And so those power supplies are flying today. When I first joined Airborne Instruments Laboratory, they were working on the USD-7 surveillance receiver system. The thing that was giving them a whole lot of trouble is the power supplies were going into oscillation. The voltage regulators were going into oscillation. They went into oscillation because the designers did a good job of designing the power supply, the voltage regulator, but along came the purchasing department and said, I can buy those power transistors at a little cheaper price. And they went from brand A to brand B, which supposedly has the exact same ratings. Well, the new transistors had a little bit higher frequency rating, which sounds good, which means that what used to be a stable network now becomes unstable and they start oscillating. So my first few years of work as an engineer was